This episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for all horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is releasing the Warriors 40th Anniversary Collection, and just in time for Valentine's Day, a My Bloody Valentine 3D 10th Anniversary Collection. Can you believe it's been 10 years since the remake?
That's
my God.
I know. I'm old. Also, don't forget, there is a brand new Elvira collection, which I am particularly geared towards, and I really want to get the entire line. There's some good stuff there. Coming next Wednesday, February 20th, another edition of the House of Fright Wax Packs. These are the trading cards that they release: House of a Thousand Corpses, Dawn of the Dead, Reanimator. This time they're releasing a full collection of Evil Dead trading cards, so get those while you can. Our Shockwaves listeners can now save 10% now at checkout by entering code WINTERSHOCK10. Again, that's 10% off at checkout, WINTERSHOCK10. Head to fright-rags.com today.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fanga is also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available wherever you download music. Fanga's book line continues, joining Preston Fessel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. Subscribe today to get issue number 3, shipping in April. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. Well worth it. That is Fangoria.com.
And finally, this episode is brought to you by Texas Frightmare Weekend, which the Shockwaves gang will be heading out to May 3rd through the 5th at the Hyatt Regency Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Great guests this year: Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, awesome. Joe Bob Briggs. We'll have
Wait, you're forgetting my favorite of all guests.
Oh yeah, tell me.
Get a job in a sideshow. Mr. Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah.
Big fan.
Texas Frightmare Weekend is presented by Arrow Video. It is the Southwest premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. You can get more details at TexasFrightWeekend.com. And you'll get the lowdown on this year's film celebrations of Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead.
I'm excited that they're doing Rocky.
I know.
I'm wearing my Rocky shirt tonight.
You are. You absolutely are. So head on over to that website. If you're heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, the Shockwaves team will see you there.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 132. I'm your co-host, Ryan Turek. I am joined by Mr. Elric Kane.
It feels different.
It does feel different, doesn't it? And Miss Rebecca McKendry.
It's because you guys put me in the corner again.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, well, this is an episode all about quarantine.
Rob's out.
Is completely out. Yeah. Sick as a dog.
Rob's just done.
Becca's at the other side of the table.
I'm a little sniffly. Yeah. I'm at the start of it. Like, I just got it this morning. Yeah. And so I'm just at the start of it.
I told Becca, it was like U.S. Outpost 31 over here. I'm like, everybody's got to prepare their own meals and microphone setup.
Make sure you don't. Take that mic if she leaves halfway through the show. You
totally.
Gotta stay away from that mic.
Yeah, just I have polluted this mic now.
Yeah, no, I'm already starting to feel it. She looked at me weird and I started feeling a little
pasty. Oh, go fuck yourself, Kane. You're fine.
Something's going on.
So weak.
Yes.
So weak. Yeah, we've only got the three of us today, but we've got a great show ahead. We have a really cool director guest lined up. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Drop us a message on the Facebook page or Twitter or Shockwaves account. We also have the Shockwaves group on Facebook that's continuously active and very opinionated.
I love them. I can't even keep up with all of it. It is very opinionated. I love them.
I think it's definitely the group for you if you're a real hater. Just go in there hating and see what happens to you.
No, it is the most positive thing ever. If you go in hating, people jump on you for hating.
You get booted.
Yeah, you get booted real quickly.
I don't know. Today was an odd day. I went on there at like 5:30 this morning and just sat there with coffee and I went down a rabbit hole of just comments and all sorts of, not just about our films, but just about just other films in general. Yeah. And I was like, oh boy.
I read about Velvet Buzzsaw, which I think we'll be talking on there. And yeah, there was a lot of contention, but I had fun looking at everyone argue about it.
Sure. Well, we should just like kick it off.
Well, let's start with the film that we all saw together, including Rob, that will be definitely Shockwaves approved.
Oh, Horror Noir?
Horror Noir.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That was awesome.
By the time you listen to this, this will be on Shudder. Mm-hmm. So if you go to Shudder right now, look up Horror Noir.
It's definitely one of the best documentaries of its kind in a very long time. Because often I worry, like we saw it in a cinema, and I always worry, is this going to be more like an extra feature on a DVD, which a lot of these kind of films are. And even the good ones sometimes feel like not satisfying in that sense. Yeah. This feels like a real movie. It has depth. It has scope. It doesn't overstay its welcome.
Yeah.
And it's got opinions that I think, besides the topic being, portrayals of African-American in the genre, it's also just interesting as somebody who, there'll be suddenly an opinion, say, about Candyman that will surprise me because – how would I ever know? There's no way for me to know how somebody else interprets that movie who's actually from, that community. So it's, to me, it was super interesting and it's just a great film.
Yeah.
It moves. Yeah. It moves. It has style. There are a lot of talking heads in it, but everybody is incredible. They all give insight, like you said, into films that you never would have looked at. And anyway, like the Tales from the Hood, I was like, oh yeah, we're going to get to Tales from the Hood, but what can we bring to it? And there's a lot of new insight that I never expected.
Yeah, I was, directed by a USC graduate, go Xavier, you just knocked it out of the park with that. But it really did clarify a lot of questions that I'd always had about some of more of the African-American films that I never knew how to kind of come to terms with. Like, I love Sugar Hill, but I never knew, should I love Sugar Hill? Like, it's a weird, and I could see that it's approached very much like the way that I would approach rape revenge films, where I'm kind of like, I appreciate I Spit on Your Grave, but there's still a lot of ugliness that is rooted within it. And there was so much that I hadn't even caught until I watched the documentary, like in Get Out, he's literally picking the cotton out of the chair and stuffing it in his ears.
Yeah.
And I never even picked up on that before.
I got that one, but the one after that, I had never even thought about the buck. That was like a mind melter where it's like, because I probably wouldn't have even used that term in my head. I never would have thought like that. But when somebody says it, you're like, oh, so this is just loaded with this kind of subtext.
It's so loaded and I never would have picked up on any of it, but it just like, I thought the movie was smart to begin with, but now I'm just like, holy shit, this movie is so damn layered. It was just
love to some fun ones like Gungeon Hess and William Crane and Blackula. They spend time on these things to make you want to watch them again and think about them again.
Right. And even contextualizing Gungeon Hess, because when you watch ones like Sugar Hill and some of the other blaxploitation horrors back to back and then watch Gungeon Hess, it feels different.
Yes,
like there's something really off about it. Yeah. And this explained why. Mm-hmm. And a history I had no idea about but was fascinated with.
And it had Miguel Nunez Jr. who from Return of the Living Dead and Friday the 13th Part 5. I mean, I have not seen him. I mean, is he included in some of the Friday the 13th box set stuff, like the EPK?
Maybe. I mean, Tour of Duty was his big show, I remember, when I was a kid.
No, it was just great to see him and the folks from People Under the Stairs and Ken Foree.
And it's not all political. Like, you'd think it had... like, you get... Like, he makes a comment where everyone else is talking about, like, you know, it needs to... We need to have positive portrayals. He's like, I was just happy to be in a movie.
Yeah.
Like, it was awesome. Yeah. That I was on Friday 13th. I'm like, it's a real mixed bag. Actors have to act.
And it really did draw attention to two movies that I've always considered to be kind of criminally underrated. Mm-hmm. Girl with All the Gifts, which was like one of my number one movies a couple of years ago, but it got really just kind of glossed over.
It was big
forgotten.
In the UK, but not here.
Not here.
Much,
and then,
which is a good movie.
East Bayou, which I had always loved, but I had kind of left my brain for a while. But when they started talking about it, I was like, oh my God, I need to watch this movie
again. It's kind of horror adjacent because it's like kind of a ghost story. But I saw that at a film festival when it came out, and I was like, 19, and it does leave an impression. No, but it is really great, and it's also we will be going even deeper into that one when we have some guests
next week.
Next week. So we can save some of that, but the main thing you need to know is it is essential viewing, and do watch it before next week. Next week's episode. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's just, and the one thing I'll say, though, Ken Foray, they make a big deal of Ken Foray surviving Dawn, and I'm just sitting there going, but the man not only survived Leatherface, he got resurrected in Leatherface. No one's talking about that, but anyway, the movie would have to be 4 hours to cover everything. But good job, Fangoria.
Well, that was the thing.
Phil Noble Jr. And everyone.
The whole gang. I mean, that was the thing. It's like, it's such a, there's a lot of ground to cover, and it moves with such efficiency, covering the very early days of cinema to, you know, contemporary cinema. Obviously, Jordan Peele's Get Out gets a lot of love, and so on. And I just love the way it moved, and it doesn't waste any time. It doesn't waste any breath. Everything is very eloquently, enunciated, you know.
Maybe it helps that it's was made for Shudder in the sense that it doesn't waste time trying to teach you everything about horror. It just it assumes you already know this.
You're exactly.
And now let's just rock and roll, you know. And I think that is that sometimes really bogs things down when it's for a major, you know.
Because usually you would go into it and it's like, let's talk about horror films and how horror films
or explain what Night of the Living Dead is. You don't need to explain Night of the Living Dead to
just
a horror fan.
Get through it.
Yeah. Very cool.
Becca, do you want to get into Velvet Buzzsaw?
So, Velvet Buzzsaw.
Yeah.
So, as somebody said on my Twitter, which I completely agree with across the board, there is a much better version of this movie that exists somewhere.
So, just to explain, Velvet Buzzsaw is the latest film from Tony Gilroy, who did Nightcrawler.
Yes.
And it reunites him with Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo and a very eclectic cast featuring Tony Collette.
Yeah, Tony Collette, Malkovich. It's got
on
just
and on and on.
A lot of people in it that you're going to go like, oh, that person's in here. Yeah. Like, it's a lot of recognizable faces.
So, I'm assuming it's a subtle grounded film, given like Nightcrawler had all those qualities. Is it?
No.
Is it?
Well, I wouldn't I wouldn't call Nightcrawler subtle and grounded. I mean, like, I found that to be
satirical.
To be satirical and over the
top.
But
it does feel real, just like a heightened real in that one.
Well, this one is like Showgirls, is kind of, or Neon Demon is kind of the world I would put it in. Yeah. I had a blast with it, but I knew going in that it was a comedy. Like, my mom watched it and immediately called me and she was like, what the hell did I just watch? I don't get it. It wasn't even scary. I don't understand it. I was like, I think it's supposed to be a comedy, Mom. I can see why some people are hating on it. I had a blast with it. I will say that there are parts of it that don't work, that are a little bit clunkier. And if I was to go into it expecting Nightcrawler, I would have been gravely disappointed. But I had a blast. It's just a straight satirical farce with a little bit of horror thrown into it.
Yeah, the counterpoint to that is I felt like this movie was a kind of a mess. I did, you know what, there's not a dull spot throughout the film. It is incredibly engaging. Watching Jake Gyllenhaal play an art critic who gets wrapped up in this world about she's like an art agent or art curator or something like that. Rene Russo's character.
Yeah, she's an art. So it's all of the different levels of the art world. And it is like Neon Demon, where I suddenly learned about all the different people that are involved in fashion.
It was like an education in the art world.
So there are agents that represent artists that therefore take commissions whenever the art gets sold.
They book it into the
gallery.
An art gallery, right?
And then there's also people who book the museums, which was Tony Collette's character books museums. And so you're like negotiating, like, I'll give you 3 Botticellis if you also run this new guy.
Right.
And so it's a lot of negotiations. And essentially, everyone is hideously ugly and horrible. just absolutely terrible motherfuckers. Yeah, the entire, like, they're all awful people.
But what you're following is this kind of young art agent who is coming up, and what happens is her neighbor dies and leaves behind all of these paintings in his house from an artist with a tortured past. And when we find him, he's like trying to burn the paintings in his fireplace. And so the guy dies. She takes all the paintings, introduces it to the Los Angeles art world, and everybody's just amazed. It has some sort of hypnotic quality about them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something within his original paintings that is haunting the art world in general and other pieces of art. So anybody who gets kind of caught up in the hypnotic quality of the painting – gets offed in a grisly, very creative way.
And it seems to target the greedy ones. And he had left in his will that these paintings were supposed to be destroyed. And she lied and said that she found them in a dumpster and instead of like broke into his apartment and cleaned them out.
It's like Kafka. Kafka's work was meant to be destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. And I just felt like this film was just a tonal mess. Like I heard that there was a much longer cut, but... Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was long enough. It was almost two hours long.
It's 2 hours. But there's just it's kind of meandering. There's a lot of stuff happening that doesn't stay on target. You want to follow the rules of these cursed paintings. You want to follow Gyllenhaal, but the perspective of the film keeps switching Russo to Toni Collette.
Now we're
going to Gyllenhaal.
I mean, literally, like Malkovich's character, whom I loved in this movie, he could have been cut out entirely because, we'll go spend 20 minutes with him while he's painting something colorful and playing basketball, and then we'll come back and it's like he's not even connected to these paintings. He's never even seen them, and then he's on the beach with sand making swirls and
it's very unusual. And there was one scene in the film that just felt like Gilroy didn't know where to place it, so he just dropped it into the middle of the film with no context as to how the audience is tracking Gyllenhaal's slow descent into madness, because like the paintings are supposed to be driving him nuts a little bit. And he's talking about seeing things, and I'm like, well, you've only seen one weird thing so far.
When he went to the doctor, he'd seen two.
Well, no, I'm talking about when he's with his quote-unquote girlfriend. He's like talking about
Is this pre or post weird sex?
Post.
Then he's seen... Okay, he saw one briefly, and then when they're having sex, the thing reaches out at him.
And that's
what freaks him out. Yeah, and then
tell me more about the reach-around sex. my curiosity.
But it's just like, it's a very unusual film, and it kind of left me cold very much like Neon Demon did. And I thought, I love weird. I love weird abstract movies, and I love movies that kind of take us into a world that we're not usually accustomed to. And I love the originality of Velvet Buzzsaw. However, I just felt it was incredibly unfocused and all over the place, even if the performances were really great.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It is. I'm not arguing that. It is all over the place and it is unfocused. And there were moments when I was bored, and then the next 10 minutes later, I was mesmerized by Jake Gyllenhaal's little temper tantrums.
Those make up for the fact that the very first scare... Like, this is hardly a horror film. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's barely.
It's got the language of a horror film at times with the kill sequences, but it just felt like it was coming from a place from someone who does not quite understand the world of horror. And that's not a knock against Tony Gilroy, because he's fucking incredibly talented. Nightcrawler is a brilliant piece
of work. Nightcrawler is more of a horror film than this is. Because I considered Nightcrawler to be almost a serial killer film.
That's American Psycho style.
That's what I was kind of hoping that Velvet Buzzsaw would lean into. Uh-huh. But the very first scare in this movie is literally a cat scare. Uh-huh. That's a cat scare.
And even that's like a good 40 minutes in.
Yes.
Like we spent a lot of time with these artists before we get there.
Yeah.
And I did not, I have to confess, I didn't like Neon Demon because I walked away from it either. Feeling cold and going, I don't know what just happened. I get that
it's
it was
pretty
weird.
Detached. That's the hard part, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
This is detached, but the kind of over-the-top farcical satire, which felt very kind of Verhoeven at moments, was what kind of kept me
not
in.
Not enough, though.
Not
that's
enough.
A, that's the thing. It's
they either needed to lean on it. Yeah.
Pick a lane and then go full on into that. If you're going to go Verhoeven, then go into the satire. If you're going to be horror, then go horror.
Yeah.
But it's just a tonal blend.
That's where I found Gyllenhaal and Toni Collette's character was like, they belong in a Verhoeven film.
Yeah.
And then some of the other characters, like the main girl who found the art, she just felt too real. Or the character of Coco, until she found the third dead body, and then it was like, I laughed out loud.
It doesn't sound as fun as the one about the haunted dress we watched last year, the Peter Strickland
in
one.
In Fabric?
I think that's
fun.
Oh, God,
no.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to see that, Becca. I think you're going to love that one.
So Josh Miller just gave me a recommendation this week about a haunted dress film directed by Toby Hooper. That's way old and only available on VHS. And then suddenly I was like, wait, did Elric and Ryan recommend this too? But no, this is In Fabric's new and this one's really old.
Interesting.
I've got to go back and find it.
This will come out sometime this year, I'm sure, in America. It was already out in the UK.
I can't wait to see it.
But that's the thing about satire, like if you go too broad, it can you satire something when you're being that over the top? I mean, Dr. Strangelove, when you watch it, seems over the top, but whenever Joe Dante talks about the story, he said, well, he saw it in theaters when he was young, and said, you could hear a pin drop. Dr. Strangelove. Everyone took it like a serious movie and couldn't handle it because it was so serious. I'm like, that seems over the top, farcical. So I think farce and satire is hard when it's pitched, when the performances are so over the top.
Yeah.
It's just silly.
I think it depends on which way you're playing it, because I compare it to A Mighty Wind. Have you guys seen that? Which, like, attacked the... Yes. You know, the folk music industry, which is very over the top, but they're actually playing it they're playing it straight, but it comes across as comedic.
His stuff's funny.
It's a messy blend. Where some of the characters, I mean, in A Mighty Wind, what made it funny was that everyone knew that the universe that this film existed in, the tone of the characters. Yeah. This, some of the characters are in that universe, other ones are not.
Yeah.
And they don't blend together well on screen.
Yeah. Well, and to kind of break off from that, the Toby Hooper film that Josh Miller is talking about is 1990's I'm Dangerous Tonight.
Which I cannot wait to see.
The plot reads, when Amy turns an ancient Aztec priest's cloak into a dress, she discovers it's cursed and whoever wears it comes under its evil influence.
A prom dress,
nonetheless. Oh my God, and it's got the most wonderful looking human on earth.
It's got Machinomic. And
yes.
It's got
the temp.
So
Arlie Ermey
and Twin Peaks.
Corey Parker.
So Josh
Anthony
Miller
Perkins.
Literally sent me an email that just said, if you haven't seen this, you need to. You will love it. And that's
Jesus
all it said.
I have purchased it.
Yeah. I have a VHS
comic. I've never heard of
it.
Wait,
you do?
I do, because I've been watching the price when he first, and it's fluctuating. When he first recommended it to me, I was like, it's only available on VHS and it's 70. So I put a watch on it on Amazon and it dipped down to 20 and I bought it.
You get it for $9 on eBay.
Are you fucking serious? I paid 20. Motherfuck. No, but it's en route to my house. All so right. I'm excited.
You can sell it for 30 to some sucker. once we overhype it on the show and then drive the prices up. It's like, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen.
All right, so that was Velvet Buzzsaw. You can check it on Netflix now. Elric, what do you got?
There's no Rob here, so let's give Rob's little company some love.
Yep.
Dread. Newly redesigned title, which I thought is actually a really
new
cool
logo.
Design. Yeah, one of their big new releases out that he gave us copies of was called Golem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very handsomely mounted movie. Like, it looks like a big movie. That's what I would definitely say. It's a very good-looking movie. It's about an isolated Jewish settlement. I can't guess when it was, maybe 1750s or 1800s. And there is some plague on the outskirts. Some of the backstory, I'm not exactly sure. And they end up being besieged by these invaders who blame them for the plague. And it's this woman who is the main woman in it, has lost her son a few years earlier and has been purposely not getting pregnant with her husband because she can't face to, you know, have another kid after losing one. She becomes very interesting in the Torah and some Jewish kind of mysticism, but you're not allowed to be if you're a woman. So she's like illegally getting the books from her husband and kind of sneaking in to learn stuff, basically, that none of the men in the community want her to. And so basically when the town becomes under attack, she gets in her head that I could create a golem, and this idea of this mythical creature that would be their protectors. In the opening scene of the movie, you see one giant golem and you realize it's malevolent and also a protector, and so it's really dangerous. It's like a volatile thing to wish. Then it goes to town and it returns. But what's the choice they make that is interesting, but there's part of me left wanting a little, is it comes back as a little boy. So it's still a golem and it's not a real human boy, but it appears as a boy. And I really think it's a good film and I liked it quite a lot. But what stopped me from maybe loving it is that I don't get my big giant golem monster creature, which is what I'm desiring when I see a golem trash people. And I would have to assume, you know, that's partially for vegetarian also, and also emotional. They tie the boy obviously really well into the story because she's lost a son. I think emotionally it's a good movie, but it did make me just go, oh, I want that kind of bonkers killer golem movie as well. But this one, he told me this. He said it is available VOD right now everywhere, and you can also get the Blu-ray at epicpictures.com. So that's me standing in for Rob.
Excellent.
But I did like it, and I thought the main thing is it really is made very well. It does not feel like an indie. It feels like quite a big studio kind of film, but it's probably still an indie.
Yeah.
So that was impressive.
Very cool. Very cool. On a whim, I've always had The Relic in my queue, and I haven't seen The Relic.
Everyone jumped on you about the darkness
movie.
Of it.
The Relic, you know, Becca.
I like it too.
What's the name of the creature?
The Cthulhu.
The Cthulhu.
And it gets your hypothalamus.
It's going to eat your hypothalamus.
I'm down for any monster
movie. It taught me science in a monster movie.
I'm down for any monster movie where it's like targeting a very specific part of your brain.
It's on the leaves. It's the leaves.
The book. I remember reading the book when it first came out. This was from Preston Sturges and Lee Child, I think it was.
Preston Sturges?
No, not Preston Sturges.
You were going deep dive.
Wait. Hang on a sec. The Relic authors.
I got sick of making these broad comedies about American life, and I went to The Relic.
Oh, I'm way off. Douglas Preston and Lincoln
You sure it wasn't
Child.
Douglas Fairbanks?
Lincoln Child. Way off.
Wait, is this a pure you cinema crossover?
Orson Welles.
Douglas Fairbanks wrote The Relic.
let's just put it out there as a rumor.
All right. So The Relic they made back in 1996.
I would have just guessed 96, actually.
Yeah. That was like that kind of weird
year.
I remember the – no, 97. I'm wrong. Okay, I'm sorry about that. This is a film that Peter Hyams directed.
Who was a DP.
For a long time. And he's, well-known. Yeah. But, Stan Winston is really the glue that holds this movie together because he created a monster that is a quadruped mix of all sorts of creatures, and it's handled in both practical and effects kind of ways. If you've never seen it, basically The Relic is the story of this scientist who goes overseas. He gets hit with some whammy juice. He transforms into this monster because of some leaves or something.
Leaves or the fungus on the leaves. I don't know. Loaded with hormones, right? And they're loaded with hormones.
Becca here is doing a terrific impression of Penelope Ann Miller, who plays Margot Green.
Terrific. It was like you guys thought Penelope Ann Miller was in the room for a second.
And here I am playing Tom Sizemore. So the movie's about this. Tom Sizemore is the cop in it, but basically this Penelope Ann Miller works for the Natural History Museum in Chicago. She receives a shipment of stuff. There's a monster in that shipment. They coincidentally have a big gala opening for their new show called Superstition. And basically the monster runs amok from minute 50 until the very end of the film. It's almost like a two-hour movie. So the first half, you've got nothing but setup. You're meeting Penelope Ann Miller. You're meeting Tom Sizemore, who's a cop, who has a superstitious way about him. He doesn't pick up the penny if it's face down. He doesn't step over a body because it's bad luck. And
he's surprisingly intense for Tom Sizemore. Who would think? I like him in this movie, actually.
Do you really?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen this in a while, but I like the whole movie.
Yeah.
I've always liked this movie.
I watched this. It was a long – I mean, this is like when I first got Netflix. This was one of the first movies that I remember going through Netflix and being like, oh, The Relic's on Netflix.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And that was probably like 8 years ago.
Maybe I'm being too hard on The Relic. I really liked The Relic when I first saw it in the theater. However, rewatching it, I think it could be incredibly shorter. But I do like that it has these kind of disaster movie notes about it because you set up so many characters you need to track. Like you're tracking the two cops who might be lovers. I don't know, because they're like really like – there's a moment in the film where Tom Sizemore is like, I need two guys to go down to the basement and check the dark corners or whatever. And the both guys are like, I'll do it. And then they look at each other with like a knowing look and they're like, bro, no, don't do that. And he's like, no, I got it, man. I'll go down there. Both knowing that one of them is going to fucking die. Then guess what they do? Anyways, I like that it kind of sets up these disaster movie tropes. You're following the mayor. You're following the rich couple who owe Penelope Ann Miller a grant and da-da-da-da-da. And for the first half, you're getting all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half, the Cthulhu is running amok. And it begins in the bowels of the museum and begins to work its way up to the show floor. And it can crawl on walls. But what it loves to do is eat your fucking brain. So it's got these mandibles that latch around your neck and pops your head off. And it kind of reminded me of the Monster That Challenged the World design a little bit, because the Monster That Challenged the World is this old like 1950s monster movie where they're basically giant snails, but they got these giant mandibles and they grab you by the neck and shake you around. But you know, it's got a lot of bad exposition to it.
Really?
It's got,
I loved the mythos. The idea that it's like this tribe.
Well, I'm saying the delivery of the exposition. I'm not saying the exposition itself.
I loved the idea that it was like this tribe that had discovered that if you fed people these leaves, they would turn into this hideous monster and exact revenge, and we all had to sleep in trees for a week until the carnage is over. And I just made Ryan start his tea. It's true. That's part of the movie. They talk about how they all have to sleep in trees until the bad shit's done.
But sleep in trees, but the fucking monster could climb a goddamn tree.
He climbs a glass, like a glass ceiling in the movie, right?
Oh, there's a great moment.
But he can't do trees.
This isn't a spoiler. This is a great moment where SWAT breaks into the museum. And you got these like,
it's raining.
You got all the red and blues outside, you know, cop cars everywhere. It looks like the set of Die Hard. And then these SWAT team members like break in and they're coming down from the ceiling and they're hanging from the rope. And the monster's like, oh, hey, cool, hanging food. And he climbs up the wall and he grabs one guy. And you got that great moment where there's a guy going, pull me up. And the SWAT team member's like, I got you, bro, I got you. He's pulling the guy up and then he pulls up half his friend. And then I shit you not, the SWAT team member like extends his arms to his side and screams to the heavens, no! And I was like, oh my God.
He was really sad.
It's just so wonderfully 90s action.
It very much is.
It's the same shit I love from Deep Rising or Mimic where it's
Well, this was the same period. Yeah. This was very much the same period. You were getting a lot of monster movies. And also, you know, at this time, The Relic was offering an alternative to all the teen slashers that were coming out. So I commend it for coming out. I mean, the book was very popular when it came out. But I commend it for offering something a little bit different. I don't remember how the film did. But anyways, I was also getting back to this movie's dark as shit.
Yeah, but that was your initial post, and that was always my memory of the thing I liked about how they.
That you couldn't see anything?
Well, but in the theaters, I didn't notice it. I remember it being dark, but purposely, like he's choosing to shoot it really dark because it's Peter Himes, and also the creature's in the dark, which usually helps the creature.
Yeah, you can't show the Cthoga all over.
I want to see that Cthoga.
But you watched it on your phone, so it's like.
I did not watch it on my phone. I watched it on my rumors. I put my TV.
Yeah, but on Laserdisc. That's the problem. You shouldn't watch Laserdisc anymore.
I would be into a remake of The Relic. I think it's time.
Absolutely, because in the book, if I remember, it was not a quadruped. It was a biped, and it had like, it was very human-like.
It was more
man-like,
yeah.
I mean, and there was like also, if I recall, there was a character that the authors laid down in the book who is an albino FBI agent.
I don't remember that shit, Ray.
But I remember he was very charismatic. He was like, oh, dude, you cast Jeff Goldblum in this shit. You like make him, you know, paint his eyebrows white. I mean, this is this guy. And I think he carried through to some of the other books. They did a sequel. There was a Relic sequel book. And it was, it was about because the original book was set in New York City. Mm-hmm. The sequel picked up from there and it was following an investigation into the mole people of New York, the people who live in the subways and underground.
Oh,
and
my God. I have to read this.
Oh, you absolutely
I wrote a
do.
Paper on them. I kid you not. Oh, mole people in L. Well, yeah. L.A. has lizard people, supposedly, and the mole people of New York.
That's why Becca lives here.
Yeah. There's lizard people.
Anyways, that's The Relic.
It rules.
Didn't hold up as well as I had hoped.
I think me and Becca have to watch it now in our new
please
decade.
Please do.
I'm trying to remember. There was another movie that came out right around the same time period that The Bone Snatcher was that? No, that was much later. There was something that was like right back to back with The Relic, which was another book one in the 90s. And The Bone Snatcher was later. The Bone Snatcher was another one based off a book that I wanted that movie to be better than it was. But I got to recall, there was one that I saw with The Relic literally within weeks of each other.
Right.
And they were both like based off
the
books
bone
I had
collector?
Just. No, not that, because that wasn't like a monster. That wasn't like a monster movie. Huh. I got to go back and
look. The Mimic I haven't seen since the theaters. I'd be curious to see how, and I didn't love it, but I always thought it was interesting. I'd like to kind of revisit
it. I love Mimic, and I don't hate Mimic 2. There was some good stuff in
there.
Gamera
did part one, right?
No, it was Mimic 3. I thought Mimic 3 was J.T. Petty one.
That's it.
Where it's Rear Window meets Mimic.
Yeah, there was one, I think that was it. Yeah, one of the Mimic sequels, I was like, this is actually a really good movie.
Okay.
The Relic. Becca, what else you got?
Well, let's see here. So I watched Down a Dark Hallway. Oh. Down a Dark Hall is what they're calling it. So I absolutely love this book.
Because that's the title.
So I absolutely love this book. It's based off of a Lois Duncan book. Mm. And so when I heard that they were doing a movie, I was really, really excited about it. It's done by a Spanish director named Rodrigo Cortez. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I was really excited to watch it. And I will say, and it stars Uma Thurman, Isabel Furman. It's got a great cast to it. It definitely skews a little bit younger than I was expecting. Yeah. So therefore, it's not quite as scary as I was expecting. Like, I would have dug this when I was 12. And it's definitely a decent version of the book. Or maybe I just read the book when I was younger, so therefore it scared the crap out of me. And if I reread it now, I'd probably be like, the book skews a little bit younger too, because it is Lois Duncan. But the setup is that these girls are invited to this very exclusive private academy. And literally like four or five of them are invited. So they get there and they're like, oh, I'm going to this exclusive academy. And then they get there and they're like, why are there only five students in the entire school? And then almost immediately weird shit starts happening. They start having blackouts. Some of the girls start developing these weird new talents that they've never had before, where suddenly they can play pianos like Mozart and they couldn't play a thing before they got there. And then it goes from there. And you can tell from the get-go that some of the faculty are kind of messed up. It's kind of a Suspiria thing where you get from the beginning that the faculty are weird. I had fun with it. Yeah, if I was 12, this would have been like my movie of the year. But this, seeing this and then going, man, this was great. If I was a little bit younger, I still had a good time with it, but it made me rewatch The Woods. Then I watched that right afterwards. Yeah. Cause The Woods, Lucky McKee's film from, probably a decade ago.
Early
now.
2000s.
Yeah. maybe even more. But this one, it's Agnes Bruckner. Bruce Campbell's in it for a hot minute, but it's the same kind of setup where it's a very exclusive all girls school. But this one definitely gets a lot more mature and is far more adult.
And the best one is, the one, but I remember seeing The Woods and then a couple years later seeing, Gaspar Noé's girlfriend, Lucille Hadley, I can't say her name, the one who made the Aqua horror film that we talked about a couple years ago where all the boys are giving birth.
Oh yeah.
But she made a film called Innocence, one of the most stunning. It looks like Suspiria in terms of color palette,
right.
And it's very subtle, and it's about adolescence in this old girl's school, but the first girl arrives in a coffin and then they open the coffin and they was like, "Welcome to school." And you're like, "What world am I watching?" And it's a movie I've been trying to get people onto for like a decade since I saw it. I actually think her movies are actually maybe even more interesting than Gaspar's, and I really like his too. But that
it's
one
called
particularly
Innocence?
It's called Innocence. I've got a copy of it, but that one particularly, I think, is part of that world, and it's so stylish and
excellent.
Abstract. You would dig it.
Well, I highly recommend The Woods if you haven't seen it. But for some reason, it didn't get a lot of attention when it came out. I remember that was like right when I was starting to work at Fangoria, and I remember it being one of the ones that we were giving a lot of love that year, trying to get a lot of respect and show for it, but it didn't really hit as hard as I thought it should have. But yeah, it's great, especially if you dig Suspiria. It's just like kind of a modern day, more developed version. It's not quite as dream logic-y as Suspiria, but it's great.
I'll say this. There's nothing better than when somebody on your show comes back from Sundance raving about a movie and you just sit there going, well, motherfucker, I don't get to see that forever. But then DirecTV puts it out the week after Ryan talks about it. So me and Dick, we pooled our money so we could pay the $11 on DirecTV to watch one that Ryan had just talked about called The Hole in the Ground by Lee Cronin. And we both thought it was gangbusters.
Awesome.
Which is actually really interesting because on Letterboxd, which I really trust, it has the worst reviews. It's really weird.
What?
It's getting all these half-star reviews from Sundance going, I've never seen a Sundance crowd laugh at a movie for being so ridiculous. There's like 10 of these reviews. But then if you go look up critic reviews, a lot of them are saying, this is going to be the horror film of the year. It almost felt like somebody just trying to like sabotage it. But no, we both uniformly thought this was a real mastery of tone. It feels like if you're into like A24 or Annapurna, you know, horror, that kind of elevated in that sense of adult drama. But it's like you said, it's Irish film. A mother and her son, they move to, you know, her relationship has obviously ended. You don't ever fully get all the answers to that, which is nice. She moves to this smaller village kind of town, into this house. They go out into the woods and they see a giant sinkhole, which I assumed wasn't meant to be realistic because it was so vast.
Did it look bad? Because when I was whatever site I was on, Amazon, like I was actually quoting a review when I said that just now. Did it look weird? Because what most people were
critiquing.
It looked
bigger than a real, it didn't feel like a real sinkhole. It felt like it was meant to be this like some sort of metaphysical Lovecraftian kind of hole. But then she looks away for a second, can't see her son. And this is all stuff Ryan went into last time. And then her son's right behind her. And then it's really about, oh, is this my son or isn't? But and that kind of storyline, I'm totally over. And I've seen just too many creepy kid movies. But what works about this movie is that in this case, it totally delivers on the premise, and it pushes. It actually has an idea where it goes, "Oh, how far could you push that kind of creepy kid notion?" And it goes so far with this, and then it actually has quite a great little kind of twist towards the end where it actually is delivering on the bigger picture of what the whole is. It's not just that I was kind of expecting halfway, oh, it's going to be some sort of abstract ending where you have to fill in the pieces. This shows you everything goes all the way. I think the performances are great. It's just a really interesting movie, and it's, I think people who trust those kind of movies are going to be into it. Like, I still have problems even though I love the aesthetic of something like Goodnight Mommy. When it gets to the end, it doesn't land with me, and I go, eh. And it kind of cheapens in my mind, which is a shame because I really love the build of that movie. But this one didn't have
this
that.
Is the same director as Goodnight Mommy.
No, it's not. That's The Lodge, which
thank
is coming
you.
Up. But they're
okay.
They were both ones we were talking about.
Yeah.
But this one's really cool, and it was really cool. I wish more festival films would do this because there's something really gratifying about hearing about a film at a festival and the next week being able to see it. That was I love that feeling.
Yeah. Hole in the Ground, now available on DirecTV.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I got one more. I watched a film called Silent Scream from 1979.
I don't think I ever saw it, but it's got a great cover.
It's got a great cover.
That's what I remember is the VHS
it's
cover.
It's just a mouth screaming.
With red and,
yeah. Denny Harris directed it. Ken and Jim Wheat from Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and Pitch Black fame.
Okay, there you go.
Co-wrote this film. Rebecca Balding stars as a college student who is beginning a new year at school. She misses the enrollment period for housing, so it forces her to start looking elsewhere. And what she winds up finding is a room at a bed and breakfast by the seaside. It's like a seaside bed and breakfast run by Yvonne DiCarlo from The Munsters. She was Lily Munster. She's got a son named Brad Reardon. She's got a son played by Brad Reardon who kind of dresses like he's 12 years old, but he looks definitely like a man. And there are other tenants that wind up who are in the same kind of pinch that Balding's character is. And they rent out the other rooms. And one by one, it becomes a body count movie. And someone is picking off the tenants of this bed and breakfast. The first victim is brutally stabbed on the beach. And you start to get the sense that it is either Yvonne DiCarlo or the boy, or it could be Barbara Steele, who doesn't have a lick of dialogue in this film. But when we first meet her, she is sitting in front of a mirror that has a picture of her younger self covering the mirror. It's like her own portrait. And she lost her mind for reasons that I don't want to go into because it's a little bit spoiler territory. But basically what you have is the story of a college student who's up against a fucked up family. And it is surprisingly effective.
Okay.
There's some really great kills. The kind of detective B story works. There's some very unusual late 70s teen stuff going on, or I should say college student stuff, where Balding's character rents a room at this place. She meets this other girl who's staying there. And then there's this kind of hunky jock type. And the other girl basically sets Balding up with this hunky jock type. And they like hook up by like night two. And I'm like, that's really complicated, guys, because now you have separate rooms. And what's the game plan here? You're going to just immediately move in. The kid, Brad Reardon's character, has got this amazing Prince Valiant haircut. And overall, it's just like a fun, cool slasher whodunit. It's got themes about depression and suicide, and it's got an incredibly grim ending. And funnily enough, I was just bitching about this like a couple episodes ago about movies that begin halfway through the story like the cold open is you're in the middle of a murder and then you're like, oh, 3 weeks earlier.
Yeah.
That's the way this film begins. And I was like, oh, Jesus, even back in 79.
It started the trend.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, Silent Scream is pretty solid. It's a solid post-Halloween slasher.
I suspect it's the kind of movie I'll put on and go, oh, yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah.
Because between that and like Boarding House, there's just certain titles where I'm like, have I seen that? And then it's like, yeah, I've seen that. Boarding House is one of those kind of movies.
I forgot that one, yeah.
It's just well-written. It's got, it's got the characters are solid. It's a fun movie.
You know it has no themes and is poorly written?
What's that?
Bloody New Year. Rob's not here. Rob introduced it last week, and then I watched it with Dick on, as it was part of our double with the really good Helen. Oh my God, this movie might have the worst characters I've seen since Microwave Massacre, where I hated all of them. I couldn't stand watching the screen, but it had these little twists when they're on the island. They're at this like haunted house on New Year's or whatever, yeah. And it has little twists like if the staircase is alive for a second or a hand comes out of a painting. So those twists, those little visual gags were pretty fun. But man, is it an unlikable and slog-paced movie. Like, it was honestly one of the hardest I've had to get through in quite some time. And but it's good. I feel like I'm not just hating because, you know, Rob liked it quite a lot, he said. And so it's a balanced view. But yeah, these characters were not fun. So anyway.
That's on my roster. That's on my roster. I want to watch it.
I wouldn't be to stop anyone. That's got enough visual gags to make it probably worth
your
time.
But you compared it to Microwave Massacre, which may be your most hated movie ever.
Those two might be for the show. Yeah, they're in that list right now. Sorry.
Ah. Something I might do is a kind of subsection of the show where we go around the table and we talk about what we watched is from the collection. Uh-huh. And it's literally me weeding through the stuff I have in the collection. And by the end, I will tell you whether I'm going to throw it in the pile that goes to Amoeba and have it banished from the collection forever or if I'm going to keep it.
I have my to watch shelf.
Yeah,
and
me too. That's a big part
that's
of
kind of
viewing.
A huge part of my viewing. And a lot of it's the things that I'm kind of like daring myself to watch where I'm like, yeah. I know this is going to be really bad. Yeah. But someday I'm going to have enough chutzpah to watch
that's
this.
That's the thing. I was kind of just, I was putting Silent Scream, what I reminded myself about is I was putting Silent Scream in the drawer and I was like, look at all this stuff. Like, look at all these movies.
Yeah.
Like, how many of these do I want to actually hold on to?
See, that's what I did a couple of years ago is I parsed everything down. I have maybe 3 bookshelves now. And I went through and was like, do I need to own Laser Blast? And then I would rewatch Laser Blast. I decided not to. Slithus. Do I need to own Slithus?
Not really.
Yeah. And then I would rewatch
did you keep
it. Slithus? I did not. Oh, okay. I did not. But I would literally go through and kind of pick and choose the ones.
You was talking to me about how some people, I started realizing doing one show with Brian, you know, Pure Cinema, and then like doing this show with Rob, I started realizing like some people are kind of like explorers and some people are nostalgists. Mm. And like, I think both of them are, you know, big time nostalgists because they like to rewatch things that they really love, like comfort. And then I realized myself, I like to see new movies.
I want
to
see new
I hardly
stuff.
Rewatch stuff.
I don't
just like
either.
To see.
That's
and
a
so
big thing.
I think that is a big part of like collectors because if you're a collector, you want to have all your favorite stuff.
Sure.
And if, and in my case, I get some new thing. I watch it once. I probably never want to watch it again.
That's the same thing. If it's a Saturday night, it's a rarity that I would be like, let's watch Monster Squad. And I love Monster Squad. If they are doing a retro screening, it's in 35mm and Fred Decker's there. Then I'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll go. But if it's just a Saturday night, I would never put that on of my own accord because I've seen it. I can basically recite it. So I don't get into the nostalgia screenings unless there's something that's really special about it. Yeah. The majority of the time, if I'm going to watch something, I want to watch something I've never seen before.
Yeah, so, it is funny. We're all wired different.
Completely.
That's the fun part about doing this.
And that's the fun part about being a horror fan.
It is, right?
I saw that meme going around on the group like the other day where it was like snooty pretentious horror fan and then you know Kurt Russell saying hey, let's watch Sleepaway Camp 3 and it's like we're all both I think
for sure for the most part
and especially I feel like as you get older listen up teenage horror fans there will be a period where you get very busy in your life and there's just not enough time for all the shit that's out there. But I think we still all remain both snooty and let's just watch Sleepaway Camp 3.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, you guys are snootier than me, but still. I'll
get
just let that fly. You know what? We all have seen Piercing.
Piercing.
Yes.
Because I know Rob liked it, but he's not here.
Mm. I loved it. I thought it was great.
It was such a fun surprise. My first only note for Letterboxd was Wes Anderson's Visitor Q because there's all these like kind of miniature things that I kept thinking of like his formal kind of perfection, but then it's kind of bonkers in terms of story. You know,
it reminded me there was an Asian film that came out a couple of years ago called Mobius. That it had kind of, and it's Visitor Q-ish where the whole time you're just going, they're not going to go there. Oh, they fucking went. Well, they can't go any further. Oh God, they went further. Yeah. And it reminded me of that in that regard.
What's the one with the girl from Juno and she goes to the guy's house, Candy?
Hard Candy.
Hard Candy. It also has a little bit of Hard Candy
where
it's like you get this nice reversal, but it's kind of a really fun little gem of a movie because it keeps surprising your expectations and you think it's going to be one type of movie and it's super short and the biggest thing for horror fans is the score is entirely
made of
giallo movies.
Amazing.
And so I kept going, oh, that giallo, ooh, there's some
tentacles.
One of my favorite all-time
scores.
There
was some jazz in there too, like a couple of jazzy when she was playing the records
It was really fun. Great.
I had a blast with it.
Yeah, but I was really surprised that we all liked it, because I was like, oh, that's not the kind of movie I would necessarily expect all. I feel like that's the kind of movie that we would be divided, but all four of us team, which is cool.
Something for everyone in there.
And I like that Chris Abbott and Mia Wasikowska, who are basically the central characters of this very
They're basically the
cast.
Only characters.
There's also...
The wife. But that's pretty much
who
it.
Who is part of a fantastic film, if you guys haven't seen it, called Victoria. Have you ever seen Victoria?
Oh, is that the long take movie?
Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
She's the lead of Victoria.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that was her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really, really good. But I just love that this film went places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the setup is Chris Abbott's going to go to... He like kisses his wife and child goodbye. He's supposedly going on a business trip, but he's packing like a hacksaw and rope and duct tape.
And practicing in the mirror what he's going to do.
Well, that's what I love. There's a great moment. We could talk more in depth about this when our guest comes in shortly. But there's a great moment where Chris Abbott is going through the process of killing this call girl that he has just called upon. And he's just kind of miming it all. And what Nicholas Pesce, the director, does so well is he includes sound effects with it, which is so much more effective and so much more grisly, I feel, than actually seeing a thing. So he's going through the process of, you know, smothering the girl with chloroform, dragging her into the bathroom, throwing her in the tub.
Cutting off body parts.
It's like sawing her head
off. Like the sawing sounds.
Holding the head and putting it in the sink. And you're like, Jesus Christ.
And yet you're not seeing this.
Huh. So no, for you're people not seeing at home, this.
This is in his imagination of what he's fantasizing about doing. And then it gets into the why, but it also goes to weird places. And I kept thinking, oh, is Mia playing like a sequel to Stoker? Is this like, is this connected to Stoker? I love Stoker. Yeah. But no, it's really kind of bonkers. Yeah. Some of the places that goes and that'll be a fun one to get in with him when he's in.
Yeah. I will quickly plug Lords of Chaos just because I have to confess I have not finished it yet, but I'm dying to get home and finish it tonight. I started watching it last night and that shit is intense. It's about members of a black metal band and a series of crimes, and then you find out that the movie is based on reality, like this actually happened. And it starts with one of the band members killing himself, and then it just kind of goes from there and just gets crazy. So it's intense, but it's gotten amazing reviews. Don't go into it just expecting a nice little documentary on black metal.
Incredibly intense.
Yeah.
How do you see that one? Is that
incredibly graphic?
It's out on February 8th. So when the show drops, it will be out. I assume on VOD.
Yeah.
And one of our past guests made a cool movie called Destroyer, Karen Kusama. Good job. I just finally saw it last night. Pretty badass action flick. Kind of weird seeing Nicole Kidman under that much makeup, though, because she kind of looks like a ghoul. A lot of the time she looks kind of like disease-ridden and just she looks like a reaper or something. But it's a pretty badass movie. What I like about what Karen's doing is each movie feels very different. Feels like she's really trying lots of different genres. Mm-hmm. But it's a kick-ass movie. Not horror, but you know, it's a fun action vengeance movie.
This is a little shout-out I want to give to Dark Horse Comics, because there is something happening right now that not a lot of horror fans, I think, know about. Basically, Dark Horse Comics took the script for William Gibson's Alien 3 and they adapted it into a miniseries. And I haven't read it. I haven't dug into it yet because I just like to collect all of it and just read it all in one sitting. But I am incredibly fascinated. And I love this experiment of taking a script and readapting it into another medium.
Yeah.
You know? So it gives you insight into... another take on a film that had many takes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I remember reading Cine Fantastique in the early 90s, and they did a pretty comprehensive breakdown of every script that had been written for Alien 3, from the wood planet to...
Vincent Ward's almost happened. It was very close to going down.
So, yeah. There was a lot of different things, but kudos to Dark Horse for
that. Is a cool idea for like comics to just take all the cool scripts that never got made and make, you know, that creature from the Black Lagoon. Yeah. It's like the podcast that Stephen Scarlatta and Josh Miller are doing, turn E.T. 2 into a comic. Who wouldn't want to see that?
That's kind of where the Big Trouble in Little China comic came from, the idea of, okay, well, we like don't sequels? Get the sequel, so they turned the sequel that they had planned into
Has anyone
comic.
Done Thing 2? Because I would love to see where you could do
that. Well, they did. Dark Horse Comics did a miniseries for The Thing that John Carpenter says is probably the closest thing you're ever going to get to a follow-up, and it's basically MacReady. If I recall, MacReady being found on the ice by an ice cutter, and they bring him on board the ship, and then shit starts to go wrong. Uh-huh. And I believe that, you know, when MacReady is put on a ship, he's completely knocked out. But when he comes to, he gets a tour of the boat. And I think at the end of issue one, the reveal is Childs is on the boat too.
Oh, interesting.
And so it begins that who's who, you know. Mm-hmm. And
which is interesting because really Childs is the thing.
Well, he argued differently in the Horror Noir documentary.
Yeah. It's the way that MacReady laughs. MacReady knows he's the thing, and he's just like, ah, fuck it.
Yeah, but
that's what I feel.
Childs
anyway, that's
dispelled the smoke myth.
He did. He did dispel the smoke myth. It's what you believe it to be. Anyway.
Anyways, we're going to bring on our guest.
Yes, from the very movie we're talking about, Pearson.
We'll be back after these messages. This episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for all horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is releasing the Warriors 40th Anniversary Collection. And, just in time for Valentine's Day, a My Bloody Valentine 3D 10th Anniversary Collection. Can you believe it's been 10 years since the remake?
That's
my God.
I know. I'm old. Also, don't forget, there is a brand new Elvira collection, which I am particularly geared towards, and I really want to get the entire line. There's some good stuff there. Coming next Wednesday, February 20th, another edition of the House of Fright Wax Packs. These are the trading cards that they release: House of a Thousand Corpses, Dawn of the Dead, Reanimator. This time they're releasing a full collection of Evil Dead trading cards, so get those while you can. Our Shockwaves listeners can now save 10% now at checkout by entering code WINTERSHOCK10. Again, that's 10% off at checkout, WINTERSHOCK10. Head to fright-rags.com today.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fanga's also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available wherever you download music. Fanga's book line continues. Joining Preston Fessel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. Subscribe today to get issue number 3, shipping in April. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. Well worth it. That is Fangoria.com.
And finally, this episode is brought to you by Texas Frightmare Weekend, which the Shockwaves gang will be heading out to May 3rd through the 5th at the Hyatt Regency Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Great guests this year: Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, awesome. Joe Bob Briggs. We'll have
Wait, you're forgetting my favorite of all guests.
Oh yeah, tell me.
Get a job in a sideshow. Mr. Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah.
Big fan.
Texas Frightmare Weekend is presented by Arrow Video. It is the Southwest premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. You can get more details at TexasFrightWeekend.com. And you'll get the lowdown on this year's film celebrations of Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead.
I'm excited that they're doing Rocky.
I know.
I'm wearing my Rocky shirt tonight.
You are. You absolutely are. So head on over to that website. If you're heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, the Shockwaves team will see you there.
Yeah.
We're back, and we have our very special guest. You just heard us talking about his film Piercing. He's also known for a terrific black and white chiller that I saw at Sundance many years ago. It feels like many years ago, although it was like 3. Mr. Nick Pesch. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello.
You're apparently a longtime listener.
Well, that film was Eyes of My Mother.
Eyes of My Mother.
And we tried to get him, but he kept turning us down on the
show. Yeah, he was just
he
way
said he was too
big
busy.
For us.
Yeah.
This is what they say. This is the story. Yeah. This is what they said on... I wish I remembered what episode number it was that I could say, an episode number you said this. They said that I snubbed them. I was living in New York, and I was making this movie, Piercing.
Yes.
Well, which, okay, it may have been worth it to get Piercing, because this was just, awesome.
Yeah,
I'll take it.
Well, congratulations on the release of Piercing. I was going to get to Eyes of My Mother, through the setup, but I just remember sitting in the theater. I think it wasn't a midnight film.
No.
It was a mid-afternoon Saturday, Sunday screening.
Yeah, we were like Saturday, 3 o'clock, library.
Everybody's super awake. They've had their fucking coffee. They might be a little hungover, but it's the usual Sundance crowd, and they're bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, not ready for what's about to hit them. And what I discover is a very dark, very brutal, very emotional story about this young woman, and it just completely shook the audience. And I remember like a couple sitting next to me just squirming in their seats throughout the entire experience. Because I don't think they understood what they were getting into. I don't think they knew it was a horror movie.
No, I mean, we were in the next category, which is like the, you know,
emerging,
new wave, you know. And there, initially, I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. We're arty enough that it's like not a horror movie. Yeah. And this is also like the conversation of like what is a horror movie, what's not a horror movie, wasn't in full force at that point. So like it was like, okay, cool, let's use this to our advantage. And we very actively were like, let's make sure that all the messaging and like everything that the book says and every blurb that you read, you don't really know what the movie is. It's like, yeah, it's a family drama and I think it's in black and white. And we just wanted people to have no idea what to expect. Because I also didn't want to sell it as like, yo, come check out this crazy horror movie.
Yeah.
And you watch it, and it is a slow movie. It's disturbing, it's slow. Yeah. And so I think we're like, let's just tell people as little as humanly possible and see what happens. And getting up for the Q&A after that was like harrowing for me because I was like, I have no idea. I didn't think – I honestly made the movie thinking that like only me and my friends would like it. And the fact that I was even at Sundance – showing it to people, it was like, oh God, what did I do?
Yeah.
Thankfully, no one crucified me.
Well, I think it was great that it was part of the next lineup because I feel like that there's a lot of pressure on filmmakers who do have their films thrown into the midnight slot because the midnight slot is supposed to keep you awake and you're supposed to like get riled up and you know rally behind a movie that's just like super insane. Whereas I feel like, you know, it was a good slot because people are paying attention. They're not. Yeah. I mean, like I learned at Sundance this year, the midnight slot is a tough slot to stay awake for.
Oh, my God,
And you need to be on something, I think, to like really power through. But so in the wake of that, you know, you talk about it being something that maybe it was only for you and your friends. You know, did it prove, I mean, obviously, clearly it proved to be beneficial, but were you ready for what came after, you know, the kind of, I'm sure you had a lot of representation, like a lot of agents coming your way. You had a lot more attention thrown at you. Were you prepared for all that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that, I went to film school and I think, you know, everyone who is aspiring to be a director has that like aspect of them that feels like, oh yeah, when the time comes, I will be ready to accept the call. So the egotistical part of me thought, yes, or I should say the naive part of me thought, yeah, I'm ready for that. Yeah. I think that like, it's a lot more overwhelming than people realize. It's certainly fun, but even, you know, the way I met you, Ryan, was at Sundance in like a,
some weird bar,
you know, parade of like, you should meet so-and-so, you should meet so-and-so, you should meet so-and-so. And I remember like I have a note on my phone from Sundance that I found the other day that's like a list of all the people, the meetings that I'd had, keeping notes on all of them and then seeing where it trailed off and realizing like, oh, you can't.
Yeah.
Can't keep track of everything.
Yeah,
if you can't remember something, forget it.
Yeah,
And I think that there's just so so much industry stuff that like film school doesn't teach you, like what an agent does, mm-hmm. what a manager does. You know these things, but I don't think that people know specifically what they do, or when people start emailing you what like a foreign sales agent is when you've made your indie and it's like, oh cool, someone wants to sell my movie. It's like, no, don't sell it to that person.
Yeah.
That's a con artist. Yeah, yeah. And like, you know, there's so much. I was fortunate that the reason I got to make the movie was I was working with the Borderline Films guys, Josh Mond, Antonio Campos, and Sean Durkin, who made, you know, Simon Killer James White and Martha Marcy May Marlene. And having people who had been through it before was tremendously helpful.
Right.
Like people who could kind of – who had made mistakes and like – taken the wrong turns to be able to say, like, listen, do what you want to do, but like, here's been our experience. This is what we did. This is what we did right. This is what we did wrong. And kind of being able to see they were guys, they'd gone to NYU. They were a couple years ahead of me in school, and they were, you know, kind of like an archetype of the sort of filmmaker that I wanted to be. And so having them as mentors made it a little bit easier to navigate and like find my footing.
Yeah.
And then even they helped me make my second movie. And I think that's a big part of the film industry that I feel like young filmmakers, it's one thing to like find your idols and like meet, you know, I would love to meet David Lynch.
Yeah.
I actually don't know what I would say to a dude like David Lynch, but I'd love to meet him. But I think it's also important to find like people that are that you really admire their work, but also are like closer to you in where you're at in your career. Like if you could find a people that are like a couple of steps ahead of you to hear like what they're going through, what their feelings are about things, but also to just kind of be like, you know, it's like having an older brother and being like, listen, this is what I messed up. Yeah. Don't do it.
Nice. Now you're sitting here in the room wearing a very weathered, much loved Dario Argento Tenebrae t-shirt. So clearly you're a diehard fan, especially a diehard fan of the genre, especially after seeing Piercing. We talked about the score earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back into your roots. What was that first genre film that you really caught on to and made you a lover of horror cinema?
I was really, really afraid of horror movies growing up. Which I feel like is the case for like probably a lot of horror filmmakers. Yeah. I find them so effective because of how much they affected me as a kid. So like I was like in middle school when The Ring and The Grudge came out, and those were movies I was like, oh no, if we're going to watch that tonight, I have to go home because I'm going to lose my shit. But there was something that was so attractive about that aversion to it, and I liked the idea of horror, and I found that because of kind of like the disconnect of tastes and filmmaking styles, like older horror movies were easier for me to watch. They didn't scare me as viscerally as a kid.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with like William Castle stuff. Mm. My parents loved all that.
Was there any takeaway from William Castle? Because he was known as the master showman of horror and, you know,
well,
how he presented.
Well, it's funny because like he's considered so schlocky.
Yes.
Like he's considered the like god of schlock cinema. Yeah. But you look at some of his movies like Straightjacket is incredible.
Yes,
like as like a writing drama piece is incredible.
Yeah. Well, plus he didn't have like a schlock thing for Straightjacket. He just had the lead actress.
Yeah.
Like that's all you need.
If
right
you got
there.
Joan Crawford,
if you got Joan Crawford going nuts. That's your gimmick right there.
And there is something about he found this way of like the schlock aspects were often like outside of the filmmaking, like whether it was the like shockers in your seats or like the smell-o-vision.
Emergo or the skeleton. I think he called it Emergo.
So it wasn't like they did something different in the filmmaking. it was kind of like marketing tricks to get people to see these movies that are actually really awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I grew up absolutely loving Night of the Hunter. And I mean, Night of the Hunter is like my number one reference on Eyes of My Mother. And
I was going to ask that. Yeah, that one would have made a lot of sense. I was like thinking like things like Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. There's all these like black and white nightmare movies I kept thinking of. But Night of the Hunter is one of my favorite movies of all time. So.
And the killer in that, Will Brill, is so effective that now when I see him on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I can't get over it. I'm still just like, no, dude, you, where's your hammer? I know what's going down. And so he is that good. And I mean, he's a great actor, but still, I just associate him with Eyes of My Mother.
Yeah, and I mean, he's one of those guys, I feel like a lot of great like horror villains are like this. He's really hilarious in real life. And like his clowny side can so easily be turned so quickly into something scary.
While we're on that, like besides Night of the Hunter, were there other key visual influences on that? Because that's one of the things that sticks with you with Eyes of My Mother is just how visually rich it is. There's another art house director, because a lot of art house and horror, that intersection, like Bellatar has those like black and white movies, or like that, the shot of the old person in the, I can't remember if it was a man or woman, in the bathtub.
Yep.
And I just remember going, wow, that looks like a shot out of a Bellatar movie.
I mean, I stole a lot from Bellatar.
Okay.
Which is pretty,
like, man, I'm onto you, kid.
Yeah, you are.
Cinema, please.
I went to NYU. I was like a really stereotypical film school kid in every sense of the word. And I do love all that stuff.
Yeah,
and
too.
getting to be like, okay, cool. I see what Bellatar's doing. I like that. I'll just do that with a serial killer and add some blood in there.
Yeah.
And I think that the thing that didn't connect with me with all that more film school-y stuff is like the subject matter. Mm. Like I always say, I tend not to like movies that are like about real life and it's like about feelings, unless it's like the stakes are insane.
Mm.
But if it's like about feelings of like a couple in Brooklyn, it's like, I lived that life. I'm good. I want to see some crazy shit that like I don't get to live.
Yeah.
And so horror feels like an awesome way to get to play with. It's like pick a genre, pick a movie. There's a way to turn it into a horror movie. And that's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And it gives you free rein, as I did with my first two movies, to kind of be like, I can make two movies that are super, super stylistically different, but there's a genre connection in there somewhere, and it's still, you know, it's my love for genre more than it is for my love of like one type of movie. And with genre movies, you just get to like, bounce around so much in a fun way that like, you know, is harder. You can't make Manchester by the Sea the same way I made Piercing.
Yes.
Or you could, and it actually might be a pretty cool movie, but it would be weird and people might not like it.
That could
it
definitely
as much.
Be a horror movie halfway through. Easy. Just one switch. But those two movies are so tonally different. And I mean, even down to the way you use color versus black and white, the comedy. I know there's probably, you probably see more similarities in some ways, but with Piercing, what was there a motivation for you to go in a totally different direction just to keep yourself, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was very actively trying to do something super different than Eyes. Like the Eyes is so specific that I didn't want people, you know, Bellatar is a guy who only
makes
kind of movie.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. Like we need guys like that and women. We need filmmakers like that. I totally lost my train of thought.
You have that has to be like in your soul, right?
Yeah.
To keep repeating the same thing. You have to be wired that way.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, I guess like, repeat, doing different things. Yeah, so I was very actively trying to do something distinctly different so that people didn't think I was the guy who did black and white subtitled movies. And I felt like with Eyes, I didn't get to, I have, as many horror fans do, I'm sure, have like a weird twisted sense of humor, and I didn't get to play with that as much in Eyes as I want to. Like, I think that if you're like a really twisted movie watcher, you might sit in Eyes and like get a smile on your face sometimes, but I wanted to make a movie where it really played in the way that like a lot of the Korean genre films do, like
really intense, really bleak throughout,
but like also funny.
Playful. There's a playfulness.
The wailing.
I saw The Devil Has That. It's so grim. And then something really funny happens to the characters.
And that kind of like juxtaposition, that like mashing together, like this is so fucked up, but I have a smile on my face and I feel weird about that. Like it feels kind of dirty, but it's really fun. Takashi Miike is so good at
it. We talked about Visitor Q, and actually I mentioned that the movie reminded me, and I don't even remember exactly where it's from. It was an Asian movie I saw a couple of years ago called Mobius. Which it had a similar tone where it is the most disturbing Visitor Q type stuff ever, but it's kind of hilarious.
Visitor Q
at the same time
is one of those movies. When I made Eyes My Mother and I started working with the Borderline guys, Tony Campos gave me a list of movies and was like, this is the list of movies that I think are too tough to watch.
Okay, you do need to see Mobius. It is a Korean film.
Sweet.
So Korean, driven mad by her husband's infidelity, decides to castrate her son. But it's the same thing where the whole time you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm watching this. This is horrible, yet surprisingly comedic. It's the same Korean tone that we were talking about with those other ones.
I have to go on a quick Visitor Q tangent. Visitor Q is a movie that I think is, for me, is, I can watch a lot and is super tough to watch.
I can't watch Visitor Q.
Because
you
don't
months.
Know what's real and what's not.
Right.
And what's fucked up is that some of that shit is real. And it's like, I don't know where you drew the line. And I watched this interview with Alejandro Jodorowsky, and he's like, I met Takashi Miike, and he showed me Visitor Q, and then he told me which was real and what was a movie, which was a movie trick, and now I think that man is a genius. And first of all, just thinking about the two of them, like, in a room, nerding out about, like, fucked up shit in Visitor Q is, like, a thing that I wish I was there for, but that movie is a lot.
Every time it rains and I get an umbrella, I think of that movie. Like, I literally rained in LA and I was like, Visitor Q. And before you came on, I had compared, the reason we'd compared your film to Wes Anderson's Visitor Q.
That's awesome.
That was my entry before you entered.
I will quickly insert, I interviewed Takashi Miike once and he wore a full leather jumpsuit like Eddie Murphy's Raw. It was the greatest outfit I've ever seen in my life. He also chain smoked.
What's his output up to
time
now? Like, he's past 100 movies.
Past
100. When I interviewed him, he was making a kid's
year.
Movie. It was a kid's movie about a pig, and I was interviewing him for that, but full leather jumpsuit. Wow. It was amazing.
Wow. Yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Well, talking about piercing, I mean, you talk about the kind of stylistic change that you wanted to reach for between Eyes of My Mother. The kind of material, I mean, like, was that something you had sought out, something that had been brought to you? I'm sure that, you know, in terms of the selection process, take us through post-Sundance, you're getting representation, you're getting a lot of people coming at you. Were there any projects that came close to getting your full attention that you really wanted to do, or you probably can't talk about the ones that maybe you still want to do. But,
no, I mean, yeah. Well, one of the funny ones, this Bundy movie that's out now, that's at Sundance. So I wasn't like up. I wasn't like trying to get that, but that was one of the first scripts that was sent to me.
Yeah.
And it is an awesome script. Yeah. I haven't seen the movie yet. And I will say, side note, I don't know if they're going to be mad at me for saying this. In the script, you don't realize that it's Ted Bundy until page 40. And that was the coolest thing ever. And of course they have to market it as the Bundy movie.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a aspect to it, because you're like reading, you're like, wow, this guy is really charming. And
what
he's,
do they
he's
call
a
him?
Totally maniac.
It's just
like
Ted.
He's just Ted.
And you read the script and you're like, how tragic is it that this poor guy is being wrongfully accused of all these horrible things?
Yeah.
And then when he shows up at the trial and they're like, well, Ted Bundy, please rise. You're like,
oh, that's really interesting.
And it was really awesome.
That's
and it makes you feel like
twist.
his girlfriend.
And I remember reading that, and like I was, it was like a one night. I was like just kind of going through the list of scripts, and I was like, wait a second, did I miss something? Did my like my eyes deceive me? And I went back through the previous.
Me too. Did the same thing.
What's this guy's last name?
I was like, you know? Apple F. Bundy. Where is it in the script? And listen, Michael Wuerwe, who wrote the script, is a phenomenal writer. Yeah. Joe Berlinger is a fantastic director. Haven't seen the movie. I'm sure they did great things with it, but that was a fantastic script. Yeah. That was one of the first things. I mean, so my next movie is The Grudge, and that came out of kind of the round of Sundance meetings, or not Sundance meetings, but the things that happen immediately after Sundance. Yeah. So like I was living in New York at the time. I had read Piercing while I was making Eyes of My Mother. I'm obsessed with Audition, and
that's one of my favorites.
Before I made Eyes of My Mother, I was like, I've never actually read the book that Audition is based on. Like, I'm kind of curious how it reads. And I read Audition and like absolutely loved it. And it was so cool to read something that like Murakami and Miike have like captured a very, very similar thing with books and movies. And Murakami is a filmmaker. So like you can see his love of movies in all of his books. And he very much pokes fun at like American movies in his books. He's a Japanese writer. And so I devoured as much Murakami as I could. They're really short books, and the way he writes is like really simple, and it like reads like a screenplay. He even writes in present tense, and it's like he does this, she does this. There's no like flourishing shit. Yeah, cool. And the
literal filigree,
exactly. And I read Piercing and felt like it was something that felt like I would have a lot of fun with it. The book talks about Basic Instinct a lot and pokes fun at Basic Instinct. And the more I kind of like read into it and looked into it, Murakami's relationship with Basic Instinct and that kind of like Adrian Lynn, Verhoeven, like late 80s, early 90s sort of psychosexual thriller is very much similar to my relationship with Giallo movies, and there's very much a strong connection between Basic Instinct and those movies and Giallo movies. And so it felt like a fun way for me to, you know, I love being a referential filmmaker and like having my movies be like, oh yeah, it's of this thing. And so Eyes of My Mother is very much my like 60s American Gothic movie, and Piercing is very much my Giallo movie. And so I knew that I wanted to make it. The investor that I was working on, that had invested in Eyes after Sundance and after we sold the movie, and he was like, oh, I mean, we made the movie cheap enough that our investor actually made his money back on a tiny indie sale, which is the key to keeping your investors happy, kids.
Yes.
And so we sold the movie to Magnolia, to Magnet, and he was like, do you want to do another thing? And I was like, yes, yes, I do. And I showed him Piercing, and it was something – I had written Eyes of My Mother, but – writing is still very much like a chore for me. And the actual act of making the screenplay feels very tied to directing still for me. So I wanted to find something where like the story was already figured out and I could just like put my stylistic spin on it. And so he optioned the book, and I started writing it while I was doing like the festival tour for Eyes of My Mother. And then while I was doing this, I was doing all the like meetings. They call it the water bottle tour. Yeah. And, you know, where they literally like send you an email and it's like, you have 12 meetings tomorrow. Yep. And everyone, you're going to walk out of that day being like exhausted, but like, I am the man. Everyone in this world loves me. And then you realize that they're all just blowing smoke up your ass. And it's like, everyone's very good at being really nice.
Oh, yeah.
And not that, like, I got screwed over at all. It's just, like, a lot of people's like, I'd love to work with you. And then No one does. I had a meeting for it was actually for an adaptation of Turning of the Screw.
Yep.
And which they've end up they've made it.
The Turning.
I don't know who made it, but they made it. And I went in there and pitched a super esoteric version of the movie that no studio in their right mind would ever want to make. But I was like, hey, whatever. I don't, you know. And I met this guy, Roy Lee, who we were talking about movies that we loved. And I was talking about The Grudge and how much I love the Japanese franchise and how grounded it feels and like – how, you know, in this world of remakes, you have a franchise that like was an anthology. Mm-hmm. It's like there's 12 movies, but they're all different. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go remake a movie. And he was like, you know, we're actually trying to, remake The Grudge. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I, you know, went through the process of kind of talking through all my ideas. And then I got the job on that and I wrote the script. And the biggest difference between indie movies and studio movies when writing a script is on an indie movie, if I could finish, however fast I can finish the script is when the script is done.
Yep.
Whereas on a studio movie, it's like, cool, finish the script. Great. I know I have to do a couple more drafts, but then like a year and a half later, you're like, cool, we're good to go and make this now. So in that, between me getting the job on Grudge and me actually going to make The Grudge, we wrote Piercing, shot Piercings, waited a year, then went to Sundance and sold Piercing, and then I went and made The Grudge.
Yeah, wow. That's how you do it.
It was looking back on it, it's like, that was crazy. Yeah, yeah. I haven't had a break since I've started going, but I feel very much like I stole my parents' car, and it's like only a matter of time before the cops catch up to me, pull me over, and are like, go back home.
The cinema police?
They're coming. Yeah. So. Did you have to, and obviously you probably are limited to what you can talk about The Grudge, but do you think you got it based on the films you'd made or based on like a new pitch, new vision for what to do with it, or a mixture of all those things?
I don't, you know, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I guess this is tooting their horn but half tooting mine. It's like I have to give credit to the producers who like had faith in me. I mean, Eyes of My Mother cost like pennies.
Yeah.
And there are some indie filmmakers who I feel like make small movies and you look at them and you're like, oh, I could see this guy wants to make a big movie.
Right.
Like you can see the movie that they're trying to make inside that mm-hmm. small one. And I don't feel like Eyes of My Mother was like, look at this huge mainstream black and white Portuguese movie I'm trying to make. And so I think that it was just kind of a testament to them seeing something in me that, I thought I had, but you know, wasn't sure if anyone else thought I had. And then, you know, I heard Seth Rogen say this once that he tries to go for jobs that other people wouldn't want. And I felt like, remakes and franchises that's not as dirty a word as it was a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was already starting to trend in that way. But I felt like The Grudge was a movie that it's like there aren't like A-list directors lining up to direct this franchise. This is like a good sized property for me to dip my toes into in terms of making a bigger movie. Because I will say, and I think that like there right now – there's a lot of indie filmmakers being given the keys to franchises. And like, if you get an $100 million franchise, that's like awesome. Grudge was not a $100 million mm-hmm. franchise, I will say that. If you get that big a movie, that's awesome. But that big of a movie is like really, really, really hard to make. Not on like a practical level, because on a practical level, on $100 million, you have so many people that, like, as the director, you're probably on set for, like, 15% of the time. But just, like, there's the business side of it of, like, if a studio spent $100 million, you better have made the most commercial movie of the past 6 months, because they're going to expect to make that $100 million back.
There's also a lot more cooks in the kitchen at that point, where the more that they spend, the more the studio is going to, like, send in flocks of people to kind of make sure that you're more of controlling your stuff.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, listen, I don't want to say that, like, Grudge isn't a job that tons of people want. I tried desperately to get it, and I'm sure other people would too. But I just mean it's a size project and a size property that it felt like a more appropriate thing for me to do in terms of scale and scope. And even still, it's hard. I'm in the thick of it now, and it's like it is a different animal when you want more people to see and like the movie. There's something really easy about being like a culty indie filmmaker and being able to say, listen, I make my movies for the small group of people that I make them for. And if you like them, great. And if you don't, sorry. Yeah. But when you're like playing with other people's money, it's like a very different story. And that just requires a sort of different headspace and different, you know.
Now, how did you, and I know you can't say too much, but how did you even approach it? Because The Grudge has such a huge lexicon and backstory to it. I mean, it started with a short film, right?
Yep. Yeah. There's two short films. And, you know, Shimizu came up with like an awesome mechanic. There's this sound and these rules that kind of drive all the movies. And, you know, there's a lot of Japanese ones and a handful of American ones, and there's a lot of different stories, a lot of different ghosts, a lot of different locations, but the thing that's always consistent is a really horrible human thing happens, and it's so bad that it stains the place that it happened, and everyone who encounters it, they start doing bad things. And at the end of the day, it's a horror device that causes people to do bad things to themselves, to others. Yeah. And I think that right now, especially, we're in a world of like such grounded horror. And I think The Grudge has always been something that's like so grounded in character because of the nature of it. They're always multiple storylines that are interwoven together. So you see different characters getting to deal with the same sort of issues.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it all goes back to like really human trauma and really and crime. And I think that that's something that's really interesting. So it was kind of like, as long as, you know, if you, I don't know how many people have like kept up with the Ju-on franchise, but they're still making them.
Did they cap it with Sadako versus Samara?
I don't know. Like, it might be done.
Yeah.
But you know, like there's different textures of the different movies, but there is always just this one unifying thing. So it was kind of about like, how do we stay true to that main idea, but do something that these other 12 movies haven't.
Mm-hmm. And what about tone? Did you feel tied to that tone, or did you feel emboldened to take it in your own?
No, I mean, definitely, it's a different tone than the old movies for sure. Mm. I think I felt like we have J horror movies. Yeah. It's not my place to come in and give you a 10 years later American filmmaker's take on J horror. So I just did my own thing with it.
Cool.
It feels a lot more like a movie like Seven.
Okay.
That's cool.
And but you know, I think I can't get away from trying to be stylistic. Mm-hmm. and like assert that as much as I can. And I definitely tried to rein myself in on Grudge, and it's still like, oh yeah, you could see me in a lot of the design choices.
But you still included like that sound or whatever it is in the...
We'll see.
Yeah, okay. I'm excited.
I was going to correct myself. I said Sadako versus Samara. It's Kayako. Before the fans,
I didn't
want to
nerd police
you.
No. Twitter would get
nerd,
on you.
Nerd police him.
Let's, going back to piercing, I want to just talk about your engagement with Chris Abbott and Mia Wasikowska, yeah, and bringing them on board this project. Easy, hard, what was your pitch to them? I mean, like, they both seem like actors who love to make bold choices in their selection process of films. So yeah. I imagine they're down to get freaky.
Both have very different stories. Chris was a friend of mine for years before we made Piercing. I met the Borderline guys when they were making James White, which Chris plays James White. Yep. And Chris is always, like, in real life, Chris is a pretty boy. Whether he'd be happy that I say that or not, sorry, Chris. Chris is a pretty boy. And in every movie, they're like, gain weight, grow a beard, look uglier, here's your pickup truck.
Yes.
And I wanted to do something. One, it was like, it would be fun to get you to play, like, Patrick Bateman, you know? And Chris in real life has this, like, really – he's a really quiet guy, but he's super smart, and you always see his gears spinning. And it's so much the quality that the character needed to be this guy who doesn't reveal that much, doesn't say a lot, but, like, is constantly plotting. And Chris is far less nefarious than the character is. But there were qualities in there. And so right from the get-go – right from the get-go, Chris was the main character.
Pretty, yeah.
Mia, I was never going to tell this story ever, but then Mia spilled the beans. So now I'm,
you're allowed
free
to.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not going to tell you everything. So, you know, that's the suspense for you. there was originally another actor playing Mia's role.
Oh, interesting.
And I will never say who it was.
Yeah.
But they were
the kid from There Will Be Blood.
No, yeah. they were injured 3 days before we started shooting, and were not able to, like, stand for extended periods of time and stuff.
Oh no.
She left 3 days before his shooting, and Mia was actually originally cast as the wife, which Lia Costa plays.
Yep.
One of the producers turned to me and was like, if you can call Mia right now and convince her to go from playing the comedic role, the comedic wife that has to work for 2 days, to playing the S&M prostitute that has to work the whole show, we can still keep shooting. So it's like, all right. And to her credit, it took Mia all of, like, 5.5 seconds to say yes. I think she was very eager to not wear a corset and, like, a period, like, costume and, like, be demure and pure, right, and a little princess. And I think that she was very eager to not do that. So me asking her to play an S&M prostitute was like, yeah, that's about as far from Alice as I could get. And she jumped into it with, like, such intense energy and, like, had so much fun with it. The best thing about both of them is that they had so much fun. Like, I think you can feel it on screen. Yeah. And their chemistry together was so good. And from the get-go, it was like, listen, we're dealing with, like, actually very dark subject matter, especially for the actors more so than the audience. It's like the audience doesn't have to go through all the trauma that Mia's character has to go through.
Yeah.
But it's like, we're here to have fun, and this is supposed to be a fun movie. So, like, yes, we have to do some dark stuff, but let's play. And it was like nothing was off limits. Nothing was too big. Everything – it was so collaborative, too. I think the beauty of doing a movie that is only, like, is mainly two characters for the entire thing is – it's the three of us, and we're all in it together. So, like, it's not like – oh, so by the way, we did this whole sequence of scenes and we have to change the movie a little bit now because we did this, this, and this with these other characters. It's like, nah, we made the movie in order. We shot it in chronological order so that, like, we're making it all together and kind of crafting it as we went. And I actually don't know if this is true, and I'm in the perfect place to verify if it is. I had heard that Blumhouse, when you guys make movies, take breaks in the middle of shooting to edit. Don't know if that's a total rumor or not.
That is not true.
Boom. Well, it was an awesome idea. And yeah. I was like, I heard that Blumhouse takes breaks in the middle of shooting to edit. And kind of, so we took a week off right in the middle of editing and kind of like, or right in the middle of shooting, got everything together to make sure that like before we went and did the second half of the movie, we knew like exactly where we were. We could like sit with the actors, go through scenes, rehearse stuff, tweak things. Mm-hmm. We like changed the end of the movie after seeing like how the characters were developing and evolving. And that's a luxury that it came. We got to my excitement drove it, but we only got to do it because of like logistical things, mm-hmm. as is how most indie movies go. You only get your way when logistics are in your favor. Right. But it was an awesome thing to be able to do and kind of like sit with Chris and Mia, watch the whole movie that we've had so far, and then basically watch it and then rehearse the rest of it and kind of see how they fit together.
I did the same thing and I highly recommend it. I don't think that most people get the luxury of it, but I gave birth in the middle of shooting and so I had 2 months off. So we literally...
Everyone give birth.
Did you do that next? Did you give birth?
I did not.
We literally had shot half the movie. I had to stop and give birth and we edited the entire first half of the movie. We were able to tell tone and everything what was missing and then completely revamped everything we were about to shoot from there out to kind of supplement what we saw was missing or play up what we liked. So it was a really good learning experience to do that. And I'll never get to do that again in my life, but it was nice.
Hey, third time's a charm, Becca.
Yeah,
if you make a Blumhouse thing.
I'm not having a kid.
Apparently Blumhouse does that, so you could just make one here.
I'm not having another kid.
There are two stylistic choices I want to dive into. One is the soundtrack for the film and how you went about that, and also the use of miniatures, which I thought was very refreshing. Why don't we start with that?
Yeah, I mean, I love miniatures in movies, and it's one of those things where, like, never in a million years would, like, a studio be like, yeah, all right, we'll shoot miniatures. It takes a long time. Yeah. It's really hard to shoot. Mm-hmm. It's not cost effective. Like, it's like, no, you're going to CG everything. You're good. But in the old days, it's like, if you had a place that doesn't exist, you were guaranteed making that place in miniatures. And like looking at, whenever you see the photos, whether it's like Logan's Run or Escape from New York, like seeing the adult-sized people in the little movie set that you know well, so cool. And I love, like, I've always had a fondness for miniatures and like stop motion. And there is, it's so awesome when you can make something so detailed, but there's just an element to it that makes it feel wrong all of a sudden. So like with the miniatures, they captured this element that we were trying to go for with the whole movie where it's like, yeah, these look like buildings, but because they're actually only this big and we're shooting them in the way that we're shooting them, it looks wrong. And like, yeah, there's something about it. And also we tried to lean into them looking a little bit more like toys. Like there's definitely miniatures that like we tried to make them look a little clunkier because there's also this element of like I always felt like this something about the story felt to me like a kid, a really weird kid playing with dolls in a dollhouse, and I wanted their world to kind of feel as artificial as a dollhouse, and so finding, like, figuring out how to make that disconnect in the world is easy when you're building sets. You know, you look at, like, Roy Anderson or David Lynch, and you can get this fake quality that's, like, so – it's, like, uncanny valley. It's, like, so intangibly off that you can't quite put your finger on it. And you could do that with sets, but – we were shooting in New York City and it was like, I don't want to shoot these buildings. These buildings look like New York. Anyone who's ever been to New York will look up and see, and it will feel. And we even tried, we like went and found some like weirder non-New York-y feeling buildings and tried to shoot stuff to see what it felt like. And just nothing felt like off enough. And I just so badly wanted the place to be divorced from anywhere that you could identify. And so like even the only exterior scene other than like, you know, you see this city like establishing shots. But the only time that the characters are actually like outside is when they're in the outside the hospital.
Yeah.
And that is all the buildings around them are miniatures comped in. So they're like surrounded by miniatures. And yeah, and the whole thing. Yeah. We just want it to be like slightly off, feeling weird. And it's even like with the rear screen projections that we do for the cars.
That's right, yeah.
It's like I wanted to – the funny thing to me about film is there are these techniques that are really, really popular. And rather than like, you know, making the rear screen projection better, we're just like – screw it. Get rid of it. Put a green screen back there and we'll do it all with computers. But there is technology that is a better version of the rear screen projection. And they have these like LED walls that are basically just like huge TV screens that function the same way as a rear screen projection did like in a Hitchcock movie. And the fun thing was like, okay, the same way with Eyes of My Mother, it was like, I don't want to make this look like we made it in 1960. Yeah. I just want to make similar choices to what those filmmakers would have made.
Yeah.
And same goes for piercing. It's like, let's make similar choices. We don't have to date. We don't have to use old technology, do it the way they did it, but let's make similar choices.
Yeah, it feels like piercing is like an amalgamation of a lot of, you know, choices from a lot of decades. It begins even with like a VHS style, you know, when you're seeing the title cards and stuff like that. And I actually thought you were just going to go full VHS, and I was like, wait a second. Let's talk about the music.
Yeah.
How challenging was it? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there is not a piece of original score in there. It's all from other projects, correct?
Yep.
So how difficult was that? Did your music supervisor want to strangle you?
No. Well, for the music supervisor was Randall Poster.
Oh, and God. So, I didn't know that. I didn't see that.
Jesus. So for – unfortunately, music supervisor is not one of those jobs that gets like repped very often. But let me take the opportunity right now to say that people know Randall Poster outside of music supervision.
Yes.
He's like, you know, and so Randy.
And he's worked with, let's just give him his credits. He's like Tarantino.
I mean, he did Larry, like he put Elliot Smith in Kids.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, yeah. He's done some shit.
Huge stuff.
So he was not miffed by a fully music supervised movie, but he was real hard on me about like what we choose to use, there are definitely tracks in there that are recognizable for fans. And where we chose to use those tracks were particularly important. Like for instance, like Goblin is probably, so first of all, take it back a second. Giallo movies have like the best soundtracks.
Yeah.
Those scores, like you couldn't, the scores are like John Williams sized scores, but like the weirdest instrumentation and tones, and they're incredible and beautiful. And you can't recreate that. Yeah. Like we tried and nothing, it's the technology that was available to them at the time, the musicians, the way they played, where those composers were coming from. They were all the guys who had done the spaghetti westerns.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that like Ennio Morricone did giallo music. So we wanted to use this stuff. Goblin is probably the most recognizable of all the giallo stuff because the Argento tends to be the most viewed giallo guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was like, we can't have Goblin all over the place. And I also felt like I can't use Suspiria. Like there are certain things that are like off limits. you know, Tenebrae and Deep Red are definitely bold choices. One of them is the end credits, so I feel like I have a little bit more leeway.
Yeah.
And then one of them is the first time we do a split screen scene in the movie. And it's like, there, it's such a stylistic
thing. I got chills watching it. Yeah, I love
that. That it's like, yo, I'm not pulling any punches. We're going there. I think the hardest thing was finding this. We knew that, like, we didn't want it to feel like Tarantino scores, I think, are incredible, but they lack the like continuity of themes that a traditional composer gives you. And that tends to be the issue with non-scored movies, is that like you don't get that like, oh, I've heard this melodic theme four different ways. So we knew that we still did want to do that, and we needed one score that was going to be the backbone of our movie. And figuring out what that was really hard, because it's like so many, it's like it can't be popular enough that like everyone's just going to be distracted listening to this other movie on your movie. But it has to be a good enough movie that the score is awesome enough that it can carry your movie. But then it also has to like balance all of these tones. And it's like, how do you take something that was made for another thing and tailor it? It's like putting on someone else's clothes.
Mm-hmm. Was that like all the colors of the dark, Sandra? Or which part?
We ended up going with The Red Queen Kills Seven Times by Bruno Nicolai. Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, if anyone has seen that movie, they're only stoked that I've used it. Yeah. No one's like, dude, you've tarnished the name of Red Queen Kills Seven Times. It's an amazing movie. I'm just saying that it hasn't been
Sybil
seen
Danning's
a lot.
I think Sybil Danning's even in that film. I think that's the photographer one?
Yeah.
They're all fashion photographer. It's like
one of the castle, characters is.
It
starts in the castle stuff.
Finding what those exact things were was tricky. And then came the moment where it's like, okay, Randy, I know what I want. How much is this going to cost us? And we lucked out that in Italy, like 90% of the movie music that was written for movies from like 1950 to 1980 something is owned by one company.
Wow.
Who basically like all the Mondo records and all that, like all they do is just like license these old Italian songs. And we got it for a steal.
That's great.
Was there anything you couldn't get, though? Like, was there anything that fell outside of that group that was a no in the end?
There's a couple of tracks that I tried really hard to get. One of them, I'm happy that we didn't end up going with what we did. But I tried really hard to get No More I Love Yous by Annie Lennox. It's an amazing song. She did not... I did get her to see piercing. She did not feel comfortable having the music in the movie.
That's surprising.
That's what I said.
That's really surprising.
Right?
Okay.
But it ended up working in our favor. It was one of those things where, like, Randall kept saying to me, it's like, you know that as soon as you drop this song, a portion of the audience is going to zone out, turn to their friends, be like, oh, I love this song, and, like, focus on the song more than the scene.
Yeah.
And it was like, let's find a song that captures that, but isn't going to distract you from it. And we ended up going with Bluer Than Blue by Michael Johnson, which has like a similar kind of 80s cheese and a big power ballad hit. But a big thing that kind of Randall steered me towards was... for the music that's not score, for like the diegetic music that's in the actual movie that the characters hear,
like what she plays on her record.
Yeah. That's the stuff where we used like non-movie music. Yeah. But then it became about like, how do we find songs that sound like that sounds like Al Green is as cheesy as putting Al Green on right now, but is not Al Green and is something that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
And so we found King Khan. And
I love King Khan and the Barbecue. Yeah. They're wonderful.
And so you know, it was about finding artists that feel classic and timeless and feel like that thing that is the obvious choice that you know, but doesn't sound like that. And then, like, for the last scene, those Gene Pitney tracks are something that, like, definitely people my age have no idea who Gene Pitney is, have never heard that name ever. And it's just got this weird tone that some of it, especially with music, it's like, who knows why it works? There's some, like, magical chemistry between music and movies that, like, when something feels right, it's just like, ooh, yeah, that makes me feel a really weird way, and that's perfect.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool. That's cool. So you've got Piercing out now, Grudge coming out January 3rd, 2020.
How's that locked now? There's a locked day for that?
Yeah, yeah, that's the Escape Room slot, which is now Escape Room made, like, made some money.
It's a new good date.
That's a new good date. Listen, people are like, oh, January. It's like, yo, look at your horror history and see that there have been plenty of successful films that came out in January.
Yep.
So there is no bad time for a horror movie to come out anymore. That's a stigma that no longer applies to anything. So that is a great slot. I'm sure you're like, are you done with The Grudge or are you now looking to the, got it.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, we had Lynn Shay on a couple episodes back.
I love Lynn Shay.
Very sweet things.
So
yeah.
Much.
Yeah. No, she's fantastic. Greatest. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much.
Very, very happy you came on finally.
Yeah.
Welcome to town.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And we hope to have you back when The Grudge comes out.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll talk soon.